19. Monticello, Virginia, August 1, 1778. Morning. Thomas Jefferson is safe. The Virginian is now 34 and hundreds of miles away from the British threat here at his 5,000-acre mountaintop refuge. Unlike at Valley Forge, there is no lack of food, clothing, or wine. Monticello's stunning 360-degree views of the American frontier offer the Virginian no sign of conflict. Indeed, it is a time of celebration. Our third daughter born, Jefferson records in his account book, adding that the child came into the world this morning at 1:30. Her name is Mary. The baby appears to be healthy, but whether she will survive the next few weeks and grow to adulthood is unknown. The infant deaths of his daughter and son in 1775 and 1777, respectively, left 6-year-old Patsy as Jefferson's sole surviving child, at least for now. She has a new sister. The Virginian is elated by his new daughter's birth, but is also wary, as has become his custom. There is no such thing as easy child-rearing in the late 18th century. Closing his account book, Jefferson sets off for a morning in the fields. Martha sleeps fitfully in her mahogany bed on this sweltering day, her physical health once again deeply compromised by the act of bringing a baby into the world. Jefferson leaves her to sleep, knowing that his wife's every need will be attended to by her personal slaves. As he steps out into the morning sunshine, the remainder of the Virginian's vast plantation is a beehive of activity, a place of building, planting, and hard work under a blazing August sun. The humidity is so thick that Jefferson begins to sweat as he strides toward the south orchard. At this pivotal time in his life, Jefferson is working with his own bare hands to transform the estate. While his slaves and skilled laborers are in the process of laying 90,000 bricks to establish 3 new stone columns to the front of the house, the great thinker is spending the summer with 31-year-old Italian gardener Antonio Giannini planting hundreds of new apple, cherry, nectarine, walnut, apricot, and peach trees in the orchard on the south slope. This is no random planting, but a strict following of the plan Jefferson prepared during his spare time while serving in the Virginia legislature last year. In all, 312 trees are being added, spaced in rows at deliberate intervals between 20 and 40 feet to ensure an eye-pleasing aesthetic. In fact, everywhere Jefferson looks, from the builders carefully troweling mortar to the pens of oxen, chicken, guinea fowl, peacocks, and turkeys, Monticello is vibrant with life. The main house is atop the small mountain Thomas Jefferson has grown to love. The estate is comprised of 4 farms, Monticello, Shadwell, Tufton, and Lego. Slaves are quartered in log cabins near the fields. Children start working at the age of 10, sometimes younger, but those who show promise are taught a trade at 16. It is in Jefferson's best interests to keep his slaves well fed in order to ensure optimal productivity during the long days of planting, hoeing, weeding, and harvesting. A typical food allotment for each slave is 8 quarts of cornmeal per week, 4 salted fish, and a 1/2 pound of pork or beef. In their time off in the evenings or on Sundays, slaves often supplement this diet through fishing and possum hunting. It has been 10 years since Jefferson leveled the mountaintop to begin the house construction, and 7 years since he moved into what is now known as the South Pavilion. As the plantation has grown, Jefferson has increased the slave population. At first, he owned 50 men, women, and children, but now possesses more than 100, some working in the house, others in the fields, and others doing sundry manual labor as needed. Jefferson is known for being a rather lenient slave master, offering cash incentives for hard work and productivity, and allowing his slaves to visit the Sunday market in nearby Charlottesville. He forbids his plantation overseers from using a whip and rarely punishes slaves for anything other than fighting and stealing. However, it is common for these orders to be ignored whenever Jefferson is away on business. In extreme cases, Disruptive slaves are simply sold to a faraway plantation as punishment, separated from their families forever. The Virginian once wrote that all men are created equal and has written treatises deriding the institution of slavery, but the truth is that he would no more sell his slaves than turn himself over to the British to be hanged. In Jefferson's lifetime, he will own 600 slaves, buying and selling men, women, and children to suit the needs and debts of Monticello. It is perfectly legal, and he needs the free manual labor to make his plantation profitable. Setting his slaves free in a bold act of humanity would completely disrupt the fabric of Virginia society. Jefferson was born in 1743, the same year as Jupiter, one of his personal slaves. At one time, they were fast friends and childhood companions. Despite that friendship, Jefferson considers blacks to be lesser human beings. 3 years from now, he will write that blacks are inferior to whites in the endowments of both body and mind. Footnote. Notes on the State of Virginia, 1781. End footnote. One slave family in particular is accorded a loftier status at Monticello. Betty Hemings has borne Jefferson's father-in-law, John Wales, 6 children out of wedlock. Betty was herself born of mixed-race parentage, meaning that this 41-year-old slave's children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren will be partially European in ancestry and partially black. Yet these mixed-race offspring, despite their fair skin and Roman noses, are all destined to a life of slavery. The youngest of Betty Hemings's children by John Wales is named Sally. She was born in 1773, just around the time Wales died. She is now 5 years old. As a girl of just 14, she will become the personal slave of Mary Jefferson, the newborn infant who has just come into the world. Thanks to Sally's mother's sexual relations with Wales, Thomas Jefferson's wife Martha is a blood relation to Sally Hemings, her half-sister. Even more shocking is that once she comes of age, and for 20 years after that, Sally Hemings will share Master Jefferson's bed as his lover. Footnote. Jefferson never acknowledged the relationship. It first came to light in 1802 during his first term as president when political pamphleteer and journalist James T. Callender published a report in a Richmond, Virginia newspaper alleging that Jefferson kept as a concubine one of his slaves, that her name is Sally, and that Jefferson had several children by her. Sally Hemings never commented on the subject, and Jefferson had a policy of offering no public response to personal attacks. Some do not believe the story, but after substantial inquiry and DNA testing, the Thomas Jefferson Foundation, which oversees and maintains Monticello, issued this public statement in 2012. Today, TJF, Thomas Jefferson Foundation, and most historians believe that years after his wife's death, Thomas Jefferson was the father of the 6 children of Sally Hemings mentioned in Jefferson's records. A complete copy of the Report of the Research Committee on Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings can be found at monticello.org. End footnote. Thomas Jefferson loves his pleasures, and the fruits of the orchard are for his personal enjoyment, as is the expansion of the main house and the tall rows of hops he grows to brew beer. Not so for the tobacco fields being tilled farther down the mountain, tended to by the largest percentage of his slaves. Tobacco is serious business, providing almost all Thomas Jefferson's income. There is no profit in being a legislator. Indeed, the cost of renting lodgings and purchasing meals while in Williamsburg means that Jefferson loses money while serving. Thus, he depends upon the plantation to stay afloat. Tobacco is Monticello's cash crop, one upon which Jefferson relies to indulge himself in a life of intellectual rigor. He is intent on expanding his personal library by purchasing as many books as possible. Tobacco is the currency making this happen. Though Jefferson temporarily removed himself from the Virginia legislature to be with Martha during her pregnancy, he keeps in touch through letters with friends and colleagues. It has been almost 2 months since the British abandoned Philadelphia, fleeing back to New York for fear that the city will fall into French hands. Jefferson knows that during the British retreat, George Washington's revitalized army successfully battled the Redcoats to a standstill at the Battle of Monmouth in New Jersey. General Charles Lee, recently returned to the Americans in a prisoner exchange, was among Washington's commanding generals.
Unfortunately, the volatile Lee disobeyed orders, which led to his dismissal and eventual court-martial.
Jefferson believes that the French entering the war means the conflict will soon be over. He is not aware, however, that George Washington is guarding against this false sense of security and is even calling Jefferson out by name to re-engage in the conflict by coming back to Congress. Indeed, Jefferson's withdrawal into private life is becoming common throughout the new states. The fanatical patriotism of 1775 has been replaced by apathy toward the war in many places, and even disdain for American soldiers. Jefferson's Declaration of Independence may have ignited the rebel fire, but the embers are beginning to cool. As the Virginian begins to work on his plantation this hot day, he has no idea that a confrontation will soon arrive, that the war will find its way to the front door of Monticello. On that day, as the British army comes for his head, no amount of intellectual idealism or newly planted orchards will help Thomas Jefferson. Quite simply, he will flee for his life. The truth is, Jefferson's very existence and the welfare of the entire new nation will be placed in jeopardy by one of the most heinous acts of betrayal in world history. And unbeknownst to Jefferson, or even George Washington, that act of treason is about to unfold.